Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're broadcasting live from the Ohio State Fair. For more information, check out our website at WOSU.org. If you are talking State Fair, you have to talk about the livestock. I've already made my way past the chicken barn, or the poultry barn, I guess. That's always a fun and chatty little environment. Generations of Ohio farmers have been bringing their prized pigs, cattle, chickens, llamas, to name a few, to the fair to compete for the glory of the ribbon. Those animals are the cream of the crop, though, nurtured from birth to exacting standards and with the best care. That isn't a universal circumstance. In 2011, the state of Ohio struck a deal with the Humane Society of the United States and eventually enacted a sweeping set of standards for livestock care. We're going to talk about how that came about and how the standards have worked. Joining us now is Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Animal Sciences and the OSU Extension Animal Welfare Specialist, Monique Perez-Garcia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here today.
Also with us is former state veterinarian for the Ohio Department of Agriculture, Dr. David Glauer. Dr. Glauer led the effort in writing the Ohio's livestock care standards. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann, for having us and the opportunity to tell our story.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Glauer, can you take us back and explain a bit about how the mission to create the livestock care standards first came about? I know the Humane Society of the United States was planning to put something on the ballot. This was the alternative.
Right. It went back to 2009, and the Humane Society, through interest and public pressure, thought that it was, that we were an opportune state or a ripe state, for a ballot initiative. We're one of the ballot states, and that gives, that's a bit different than some of the other states, so it makes us a little more open to that. And so they came, and they were putting together their ballot issue, and then through the efforts of the industry, and then at that time Governor Strickland, Farm Bureau, they came together, met with the Humane Society, and said that they would that we would put forward an issue two, and so issue two went on the ballot in November, and that the purpose of that issue was that if it passed was the creation and the creation of the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board. So as we all remember, the ballot initiative did pass. It was probably the fastest, one of the fastest, at least, track records for legislation that came down the way. And the legislation, House Bill 414 or whatever it was, I don't remember the number for sure.
I don't remember.
But I think, it was passed and signed by the governor in March. And so from that standpoint, it gave the department, it charged the Department of Agriculture then with establishing a set of rules or standards, and of which there weren't any, in the United States. So we were the first to take on that challenge of trying to put together that set of standards. And so I guess I became involved in that June, July time in 2010. And so then, through Dr. Tony Forsey, that was the current state veterinarian and the director of agriculture at that time, we began work on a set of rules, and it was a year long challenge to get that done, because we dealt with not only cattle, but we broke it up into veal, dairy, and beef. We looked at chickens, from the standpoint of layers, broilers, and turkeys. Sheep and goats, equine, and then alpaca llama. And so, the board has the right, the director can add other animals, but those are the animals that we have dealt with. It would have been impossible to expand that at that particular time. And so through the efforts of the Department of Agriculture, we brought together subcommittees with people that had interest in beef cattle, so we looked at producers, we looked at the university, we looked at the veterinary profession, and marketing, and brought those people together. And it was a similar chore for each then of the subcommittees. And so we'd get together and sit around a table like this, and you'd throw out ideas, and we made notes, and then started. Then my job was to try and to put it into some kind of a form that we could use. And so I spent more time learned more about a computer than I ever needed to know, and spent days just looking at that, and then like 100 meetings with all of those those groups. And once then we had a set of rules. That was the species subcommittee, and then we had a technical advisory group from the university, and some of your predecessors, were part of that, and some of the people that are still there. And so we took that and sat around the table with them and tried to put the finishing touches on it. Then that rules went to the Livestock Care Standards Board, and through a bunch of discussions, some positive, and then we had some. We had to debate some of those,
yeah.
We ended up then with a set of rules that was in starting in 2010, 2011. I don't remember the date we went to JCAR, but that joint agency for rule review,
right.
And so I should have mentioned too that I mentioned the people that were involved. But we also, those were open meetings. And so, each of the subcommittees and all of the others were open committees or open meetings. So
right.
We had public there, and so there was a time for public to put in input during the construction. And then they also had the opportunity again from a perspective standpoint during the JCAR review. And so finally we got the rules through. The first three or four chapters were adopted like in April, and then the next set of chapters in September, October, and then they became effective. So that's kind of the short.
That's a thumbnail. That's a great summarization. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're broadcasting from the Ohio State Fair today. The WOSU booth is located in the center of the fair at Central Park, along with some beloved PBS Kids characters, Daniel Tiger, Super Y, and Curious George. They'll be here till 3 p.m., so join us. The sun is just poking out right now. So might get a little steamy, but it's a gorgeous day here at the Ohio State Fair. We're talking about the livestock care standards that were first came about in 2011. They were unveiled and they went into effect. You just heard from Dr. David Glauer. He's a former state veterinarian for the Ohio Department of Agriculture and serves on the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board, which established those rules. Also with us, Monique Paris Garcia, OSU Assistant Professor of Animal Sciences and the OSU Extension Animal Welfare Specialist. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How have the standards been received by farmers? Professor Paris Garcia, you're out there, in the field. How have they worked from where you sit? You're from Iowa. You weren't around when all of that was taking place, but you see how they work now.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Ohio in general is that we are one of the few states that has legislation in place for animal welfare. A lot of animal welfare of the movement, as well as changes on farm, are really being driven by the consumer. And like anything, any change, regardless if it's related to our animals or it's just related to our life, the initial aspect or the initial kind of thought about it is very frustrating and scary, and it's big to change. Where we're seeing a lot of that change happening first is facilities. And facilities, there's a lot of economic input into a facility, into changing, retrofitting, building a new one. I work a lot with pork producers, and we're starting to see a lot of pork producers transitioning from those gestation stalls to group housing systems.
The gestation stalls are what we think of as where they're just blocked in and they aren't able to move.
Yes, so a sow will be in a gestation stall during the time that she's pregnant, and then she'll be moved to a farrowing stall where she'll have her litter, and that stall is designed to protect the piglets, but the gestation stall is really where we're focusing on. And the idea is that the gestation stall prevents certain natural behaviors, so the ability to turn around, stand up, lie down, to be able to freely move. And so really where a lot of that push is coming from is the idea of getting them out of those stalls and moving them into group systems where they'll be in groups as small as 10 up to 60, 80 sows at a time.
So how's it working? How are how's the industry taking it? I know we're going to hear from a farmer later on in the program, but from where you sit.
Yeah, the success of any change on farm comes down to the people.
Yeah.
And so when we are dealing with animals in stalls or we're dealing with animals in housing systems, it can be just as successful either way. We're going to have our challenges. There's definitely differences with group housing. So in sows in particular, they are very aggressive animals. So you do have to deal with fighting and managing that. But what I have seen on farm, and especially from the Ohio producer standpoint, is a commitment to change, a commitment to do what's best for the animal, and a commitment to remain productive and remain efficient.
Those had to be, Dr. David Glauer, some tough conversations sometimes, because you're talking about generations of tradition in farming that people had done. Now, things change over time. We all know that about crop rotation and all that kind of stuff. People know things change, but with livestock, how long had it been the way it was by the time the new rules came along?
Oh, let me step back one time.
Sure.
You said that I was a member of the Care Standards Board, and the Care Standards Board membership is set by legislation, so I served as a technical writer.
You're not on the board.
So I am not on the board, no. So just to make sure that's clear.
Okay.
Doctor, we moved into farrowing pens back in the 60s, 70s. You know, we were still on pasture, you know, and in A-framed huts, you know, in that late 50s, 60s. So farmers, you know, back in that late 60, early 70 time, you know, said, you know, you had so much death loss, you know, with baby pigs, you know, they got laid on.
Trampled,
Weather aspects, predator aspects, and they said there has to be a better way. And so that was the inception, I think, of the confinement aspect, you know, and they found that they could manage their sows better. They could see them. They took good care of those sows. And admittedly, you know, there were some of their natural habitat that was not able to be exposed to, but they were able to provide a safe, affordable product to the consumers. And I think that was a driving factor, you know, that the pork industry, you know, followed. And so by the time that we got to meeting in 2010, or the legislation and working on that, we knew that by that time, one of the northeastern states, Florida, I think...
Oregon, California, in terms of gestation stall.
Yeah,
bands.
New Mexico, Arizona. One of those that had very few swine in them. You know, they had ballots, you know, and said that they were going to do away with the gestation stalls. Well, we have a good, you know, we've ranked somewhere in around eighth in pork production in Ohio, in the nation. And so we've got, you know, we had a good group of farmers. And so, but they could see that the handwriting was on the wall and that things needed to be done. And so they were very forthright, you know, in setting a date of 2025 when, you know, we would transition away from the gestation stalls. However, as Dr. Perez has said, that we knew that there was an issue with sow behavior. And so we made provisions where that we could keep those sows in those gestation crates, you know, until we were assured of the pregnancy. You know, that's also a welfare issue that came out of this. So the industry was very, very, very good in thinking this whole subject through.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're broadcasting from the Ohio State Fair today. We are located in the center of the fair at Central Park. I'll be here till 2 o'clock at our booth, so drop by and say hi. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Dr. David Glauer. He's a former state veterinarian for the Ohio Department of Agriculture and serves as a technical writer for the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board. Also with us, Monique Perez-Garcia is an Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Animal Sciences and the OSU Extension Animal Welfare Specialist. Once again, questions or comments, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You're listening to a special live broadcast from the grounds of the Ohio State Fair. For more information about WOSU Day at the fair, check out our website at WOSU.org. Fast food chain McDonald's and Kroger grocery stores both plan to transition by 2025 to offering only eggs from cage-free facilities. These examples are part of a larger trend of consumer-driven change in how the food we eat is grown and raised. The eggs, pasture-raised beef, antibiotic-free pork, and free-range chicken are some of the most prevalent demands. This hour, we're talking farm animal welfare and how agriculture production practices are changing. Still with us is Ohio State University Extension Animal Welfare Specialist Monique Perez-Garcia. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And former state veterinarian for the Ohio Department of Agriculture, Dr. David Glauer. Thanks again for joining us, Dr. Glauer.
Appreciate it.
What are the penalties? Well, first of all, Dr. Glauer, would you describe the livestock standards that we've been talking about, the first of their kind in the country, would you describe them as bare minimum or more progressive than that or more, you know, pretty demanding and challenging? How do you describe it?
We set out to put together the care standards because there were none out there that you could really put your arms around. So we have really dealt and what we thought was the best practice for the animals that we're dealing with. And the rules do reference minimum, you know, some minimum standards, you know, that they can meet. However, you know, having said that, people are always looking at that next step. And so I think that, you know, the dairy industry are looking at discontinuing with the docking of cowtails by January 1 of 2018, and the fact that the pork is going to transition. You can't build new chicken houses in Ohio that unless they have enriched cages. You know, changing the veal industry, giving them more room. You know those animals after they're 10 weeks of age. You know they need to be housed in group settings. So I think that. You know, the rules are minimum, but we've moved agriculture down the road, you know, from this welfare aspect, I think.
Professor Perez-Garcia, you said that animal welfare practices should be based on objective science instead of just going with our initial gut reaction. Can you talk about what that looks like in the field and where the dichotomy is between what it feels like we're seeing and what's happening?
Yeah, so, you know, the interesting thing is that we do have the general public very much interested in where food comes from, but Columbus is a perfect example and where we have a very strong urban area and we don't get a lot of experience or exposure to agriculture. So a lot of the things that we talk about or a lot of the reactions come from just a gut reaction of our experience with companion animals or our experience on what we think should be happening on farm. Where we really focus on in the animal science department is to address those questions and concerns, but in a way that I can objectively measure a positive benefit for the animal. So from an animal welfare science standpoint, we look at behavior of the animal, we look for abnormal behaviors, we look for behaviors that are performed too much or not often enough. We look at the physiology of the animal, so how would a change in something impact the internal environment of the animal? So does it change her heart rate? Does it change her respiratory rate? Does it change stress hormones? And then we also look at it from a production standpoint. We know that animals are not going to be productive if they're not healthy and that they're not coping with their environment appropriately. So we really try to look by putting these animals in these much more controlled environments to see how, in fact, does changing a facility or changing a feeding regimen impact the individual animal itself.
Dr. Glauer, there was an incident in 2010, I think, either late 2009 or 2010, where there was a video released of a guy beating a cow with a crowbar, and it went viral. It went all over the place. I don't know, Dr. Perez-Garcia, if you are familiar with that. Yes. It went all over the country. But there were people, and the guy was eventually prosecuted, convicted, that kind of a thing for abuse. But there were other people saying, well, you know, sometimes managing livestock, farm livestock, is not the prettiest thing to watch. It can be brutal. And I'm wondering what about that manhandling, for lack of a better word, of a beast like that? What is it? Was that addressed in the livestock regulations?
as we put those together, you know, we use the term, you know, we define humane, you know, that to minimize pain and injury, you know, and distress. And so then we said that handling or moving of those animals needed to be done in a humane way. And certainly the incident that you described was not in a humane way. And so that's the reason why that there was some penalties, you know, mm-hmm. involved. With our law, we deal with civil penalties. Animal cruelty still is dealt with on a local basis, you know. And so there we have two different agencies, if you will, you know, right. that are looking at the legal side of you know, of that from a violation standpoint. So certainly, you know, the use of a crowbar, you know, we say in there that they need to be moved humanely. You know, the recommendation is for paddles. We've said that there are certain weight limits in animals that you can't use the old electric prod on. You know, so I think we've been forth. Yeah, I think we've looked down the road, you know, looking at the future of that, trying to make sure that our animals are being handled humanely, and you know, and our farm enterprises have gotten large enough where we need to have additional workers there, and so the industry is encouraging their members to do better training, you know, of the people that they hire, you know, and certain standards, certain levels that they have to meet. So I think that we are looking at the overall welfare of these animals.
And from a handling standpoint, that's a challenge across all livestock. So it's not a dairy issue right. alone. And what we've actually seen is, in addition to livestock care standards, the industry as a whole, swine, poultry, Beef Cattlemen's Association have all stepped up and really trying to make it very clear on what's acceptable and what's not. And what was on the video was not acceptable, and really creating tools or educational material for farmers to understand that animals can be very frustrating when you're moving them, and that there are things that are okay and there are objects that are okay to use, and there are things that are unacceptable.
Well, we've always heard the thing, herding snakes, herding cats, that kind of a thing. No one ever says herding cows being particularly. We're broadcasting from the Ohio State Fair today. That's why we're hearing lots of outdoor sounds, including overhead planes, and also lots of kids lining up, because it is PBS Kids Day at the fair, and there's some beloved PBS Kids characters here, Daniel Tiger, Super Y, and Curious George, and I'm not PBS, but I'm a 89.7 NPR character, so if you want to come out, I'll be here till 2 o'clock hanging out at the at our booth at the center of the fair at Central Park. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about Ohio's livestock care standards. You heard from Dr. David Glauer. He's a former state veterinarian for the Ohio Department of Agriculture, and also Professor Monique Perez-Garcia from Ohio State University. She is the OSU Extension Animal Welfare Specialist. William in Mount Gilead, you're on the air. Hi, William.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I have a concern that I would like to bring to your attention and get a response on, and that is, I believe the most inhumane procedure that's done on farm animals that I have rarely, if ever, heard discussed publicly, and that's the horning of feeder age cattle, and or any age cattle for that matter.
Dehorning, okay.
Terrible procedure, although anesthetic is sometimes used. Often it's not, or if it is used, it's not adequate, either in time or location to provide adequate anesthesia for these animals.
Well, let's hear from our experts now, William. Thank you so much for that call. Dr. Perez-Garcia?
Yep. So when we think about dehorning or disbudding, there's two procedures. Disbudding occurs when the calf is younger, and it's usually performed using a hot iron cautery. So you're destroying the horn buds that are going to eventually develop into a horn. Dehorning, as the gentleman on the phone was talking about, occurs when it's later on, when the horn's actually developed. And the reason why that occurs, or the reason why it's done, comes down from the safety of humans as well as the safety of other cattle. Those horns can get very big. They can cause really extreme injury in certain situations. And so the reason or the justification behind doing that is to try to protect the people working with those cattle as well as the cattle themselves. He is absolutely right on both of those procedures cause pain to the animal. And one thing that we're really focusing on, and an animal welfare trend that you're going to see a lot more on, is pain management on farm. So as from a veterinarian's perspective, we're looking at options for us to provide both short-term and long-term pain management. We do use some anesthetics, kind of like if you were going to get a cavity filled at the dentist. It's a lidocaine block. It's going to prevent some of that pain from that animal being felt. But we're really being challenged from the veterinary community to find drugs or to find alternatives to be able to extend out that pain management. Alternatives to not using disbudding or dehorning would be to be working with cattle more, trying to get them more tame. But it is something that is definitely a concern and not something that we can eliminate entirely. But what we need to be focusing on is making that as painless as possible.
Did you want to say anything, Dr. Goldberg?
I was going to say also there are some advancements in genetics, too. You know, we've had some of our breeds that have been polled, but we've got a lot more effort being put in that place where animals are born without horns. They're called polled animals, and there's been an issue about whether they maintain as good a production. But nevertheless, you know, we're looking at all things, and from a veterinary perspective, we really did not have the drugs, you know, to really be forthright in preventing the pain. So there's been a lot of development along that line. We've always had lidocaine and could do that with the larger animals, and the rules address dehorning and say that, you know, that you want to disbud before that horn erupts through the skin, and then after that you have to use pain management.
William, thanks a lot for your call. Jeremy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I just wanted to say that I feel that if livestock producers truly had nothing to hide in terms of the way they treat the animals, and they would they have the technology and very cost-effectively to put cameras to show 24 hours, people could log in and monitor the behavior of the animals and see how they're treated and see what their lives are like. And I think that would be helpful for lots of reasons. So people would have a better understanding of, you know, what they're eating, and mainly that, you know, any of these concerns that people have about, which are well-founded, I think, about how the animals are actually treated could just be addressed with, you know, simply logging on and looking. So I think that, just again, if farmers really have nothing to hide, I think they should be completely transparent and have cameras for everybody to check out what they're doing. So that's all pretty much my comment and your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Jeremy, thank you.
And we've actually seen a change in that, at least in the last 5 years. So we do have a lot of producers, some in the state of Ohio, that have placed cameras into their barns to be more transparent. We're really trying to encourage a lot more farm tours. We're trying to encourage, we have some of these agritourism where we actually have farms that people can come on and be able to see what's going on. I think there's an inherent fear to be on the camera anytime, even if we put a camera in someone's house, on how things can be portrayed or perceived just by a snapshot or just an image. So I understand the reluctance of, I definitely wouldn't want to be videotaped all day long just doing regular everyday things in my life.
So much farming is so remote now. There's just one person doing the job that many used to do before. They're on their own a lot, right? There isn't a lot of oversight.
I would say in the swine industry, that's not necessarily true. So from the standpoint of on the farm, there's going to be usually a couple main caretakers that are going to be taking care of the animals, but the producers really have a strong relationship with the veterinarian. If it's a larger company, there's usually a site manager or people that go around to multiple sites to ensure things are going on. But I will say this whole rural component and the fact that you can't walk down the street from where your house is and go into a farm or go into and see animals, it makes it kind of this extra mysterious or extra, you know, what are they hiding behind those doors? So we are really trying to work hard, at least at the university, to become more transparent, to recognize the things that we need to explain or educate better on, and then also always recognize that producers are trying to be as proactive as possible in improving welfare and that we can do better.
Dr. Glauer, getting back to the Ohio Livestock Care Standards for just a moment, are there penalties for not adhering to the standards? Are there carrots and are there penalties and are there
The department can bring forth civil penalties, which are different than animal cruelty, standards that would be coming under local. So we do have penalties that can be in place. If we're complaint driven, if we have a complaint, we go look, see what's going on. And issue them a notice of violation. They have so long to correct it, and then if they don't, then it can be taken forward to our legal staff.
Have there been many penalties issued?
I can't answer that accurately. It's been a bit since I've seen that number.
Okay.
There have been a number of investigations. Take place. The care board meets three times a year. And we are always updated on the number of investigations and then the penalties. The most of the people really want to comply, and so if they are shown what the problem is, most people do comply. They correct the things that they can do. So,
and also there's a lot of the standards that are going into place. They're being rolled out over time. And so it's not as though they was one day it was one thing and the next day it was another. They've had time to adjust, and there's rules about if you're going to build new facilities, then you have to adapt those to the new standards, right? Let's talk a little bit about sick animals. There's a lot of issues about that. A lot of people want to know where their food comes from now, because that way it makes it easier to track back if there has been a problem. What safeguards are out there to prevent sick animals from getting into the food supply? Dr. Perez-Garcia?
So the main focus that I would say that has been really beneficial on that is a strong veterinary client-patient relationship. So something that's taken very seriously among producers is to work with their veterinarian to ensure the best health for the animal. We really have an advantage with technology and where veterinary medicine has gone is that we have opportunities to vaccinate, to eliminate the disease. We also have opportunities to use antibiotics judiciously when animals are sick. There is a huge component also from the caretaker standpoint that we manage and operate those animals in a way that we aren't letting them get compromised. And so on each farm, you'll have a hospital pen where you have individual animals that are getting their care for them. And we also do, and maybe Dr. Clower would want to speak more on this, is just ensuring that there's certain requirements that those animals have to have before they would go on a truck. So sick animals that cannot rise, that cannot walk on their own, will never go into the food chain because they will not leave that farm. And we also will have animals that if they have received antibiotics, they have what we call a withdrawal period, which is a period of time from the last time they received the antibiotics to when they are able to actually go into the food chain.
When you talk about judiciously using antibiotics, has that changed a lot over time, what that means?
Absolutely. And we're really seeing a huge change right now because we're seeing some of the legislation change in terms of what antibiotics are able to be used on farm. And so the key that we're focusing on is using antibiotics to prevent or to actually treat diseases. And so really looking at that from the individual animal standpoint, looking at that with the veterinarian involved very heavily. And so we've seen a huge change in that. And I think part of it comes from this desire to have an antibiotic-free niche market or just having more focus on what antibiotics we're using and why we're using them.
The industry's really been really forthright in pursuing that with the pork quality assurance or
absolutely.
The beef quality assurance. And part of that deals with proper use of drugs. The American Veterinary Medical Association, along with various of the industry groups, are looking at the judicious use. And so with the way antibiotics are being restricted and put under the sole guidance of veterinarians, we will have a better system. Plus the fact, we do have the safest foods supply, in the world. And not only do we make sure that the farmers and veterinarians comply with that withdrawal time, but we also have a staff out there that are inspecting carcasses, on a daily basis so that, that diseased animals don't enter, and a certain percentage of those animals where there is some suspect are then tested for drug residue also.
Monique Perez-Garcia, I'm going to say goodbye to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm going to go enjoy the fair now.
Yeah, Monique Perez-Garcia is OSU Assistant Professor of Animal Sciences and the OSU Extension Animal Welfare Specialist. She's right. We are broadcasting live from the Ohio State Fair today. Our booth, the WOSU booth, will be here till 3. It's located at the center of the fair at Central Park. It is PBS Kids Day at the fair, and some great PBS Kids characters are here, Daniel Tiger, Super Y, and Curious George, till 3 p.m. So bring the kids. Come and enjoy the day. The weather's great right now. Also with me, Dr. David Glauer, former state veterinarian for the Ohio Department of Agriculture, and he serves for the he works for as a technical writer for the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board now. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is a special live broadcast from the Ohio State Fair today, talking about farm livestock welfare and how agriculture production practices are changing. Still with us is former state veterinarian for the Ohio Department of Agriculture, Dr. David Glauer. Thanks again for joining us, Dr. Glauer.
Appreciate it. Thank you for asking.
Also joining us now is fourth-generation farmer and past president of the Ohio and National Pork Producers Council. He's also a member of the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board, Brian Black. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Brian, you serve with Dr. Glauer, or you serve on the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board. What do you make of the board as a farmer? What does it do for you?
Well, it's a unique mix of individuals. We obviously have producers involved, but we also have academia and veterinarians, and even those representing whether it be organic or all natural or food banks. We've had a real nice mix of folks. I think we've done excellent work. I mean, they did the bulk of the work early on by setting the standards, mm-hmm. and I was very fortunate to be the chairman of the subcommittee for the pork industry that wrote those or helped write those rules. But then as some of the original board members were termed off, I was asked to by the governor to be on the committee, and I've enjoyed it.
So you're past president of the National Pork Producers Council. How is this Livestock Care Standards Board in Ohio viewed from the outside? What do people make of it?
Oh, my. When we got this thing finalized and people around the country could see what we did, which was take a proactive measure to show the public that we care about our livestock and that we're going to do the best job that we can, that we are really a poster child for other states around the country, especially in the Midwest, who are heavily invested in livestock and are seeing these same type of issues come down the pike.
And there were fears at first. There's a lot of back and forth back in the day when it went on the ballot, and then when the standards were being developed. What were the fears? Did you have any fears? Were you concerned when this became an issue in Ohio?
Well, sure. We all had fears that we would have our ability to produce pork and beef and whatever extremely hamstrung by forces outside of our control and by public perception rather than scientific measures that we and the industry use. I think over time we have come to accept the fact that public perception is part of our overall scheme, that even though we know one particular area, such as individual sow housing, is an issue, it doesn't look good on a 30-second soundbite, and it's very hard to explain to a consumer why we do those things. We are moving towards a group housing system, which creates its own unique set of challenges.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Brian Black. He's a fourth-generation Ohio farmer, past president of the National and Ohio Pork Producers Council, and a member of the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board. Tell us about your farm, where it is, the size, what you do.
Well, we're in Fairfield County, and like a lot of producers, we have transitioned over the years. When I was a kid, we were all outdoor production and maybe had a total of 20 or 30 sows. As I graduated from Ohio State University and came back to the farm, we increased, and that was about in the late 70s, early 80s, when this whole concept of confinement production and ramping up and being more specialized in one species was taking place. So we went through that phase until the late 90s, and several circumstances, whether it was family or the market conditions, caused us to be even more specialized, and now we currently are a contract producer for another company, and we actually produce replacement gilts for other farms, not only in Ohio, but around the country.
Replacement what?
Replacement females, would be the mamas to be. In fact, we just sent some out of the country here the 1st of July. So it's a really interesting time for me. In pork production, it's a little more specialized than it was, obviously, back in the 70s. But having these care standards gives us an excellent template to go by.
For the consumer, the idea of that pasture-raised grass-fed beef sounds like a humane and even healthy choice. Are farmers sympathetic to those desires? You went through the transition into that more industrialized approach, yes, and now are seeing a change from that.
In my opinion, consumers have a utopia view, an old McDonald's view of life on the farm, how pigs would be or cows would be outside frolicking in knee-high grass and eating dandelions, and it's all peas and carrots.
Right.
That happens maybe a half a dozen days a year in the state of Ohio and around the Midwest. The other days, when it's like it has been this last week, extremely hot, humid, or if it's cold and muddy, farmers have found out that if we bring those animals to a controlled environment, my pigs, and I've told all of my neighbors this, that my pigs have it a lot better than we do in the summertime. They sit in an air-conditioned barn. They have access to feed and water at all times. Things have definitely changed over the years, but that whole perception of they're actually more enjoyed or enjoyable outside is just not the case. And
is part of that due to advertising? You know, when we look on our milk carton, there's a picture of a cow in a field with the sun in the background, kind of a thing. Same thing with meat. I mean, there's just this image is also partly projected by the industry.
Sure. Well, yes, it's
maybe not you, but maybe
the retail
the
industry,
really big,
the wholesale, sure, and it's all advertising, and it's very similar to what all natural. You want to buy something all natural or milk with no hormones in it. Well, milk doesn't have hormones in it, it's creative advertising that's selling this stuff, It's just a way to advertise, I guess.
I remember one of my favorite professors from Michigan State, a sociologist, told us a story about how he one time brought a live chicken to a Christmas dinner with all the kids around to tell them that this is what they were eating. And it caused a riot in the house, I guess, among all of his relatives. But he was making the point of how dissociated we are with our food systems now.
Yes, and it's just because, we're, as a general population, are 4 and 5 and 6 generations removed from the farm now. And I think Ag Secretary Vilsack said it best here this last week, something to the effect that if you're not a farmer, it's because there are farmers. And we have farmers that go out there and do that job so that you don't have to get up every morning and raise your own food and grow your own stuff.
Agriculture is really interesting at this particular stage, as you've indicated, Brian, and I think that the thing that we need to remember is that we have a consuming public out there with a variety of different tastes and different concerns and likes, and so, we have Brian's type of farm, but then we also have those that have a niche market, that may want to do that pasture-raised pork or pasture-raised beef. And there's a market for that. And as long as they follow the standards and do the right thing, you know, it's a perfectly legitimate agricultural aspect. And so we are not all going down the same path, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of opportunity.
Carol in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Carol.
Yes, hi. I wanted to comment and ask a question. My understanding is that the Humane Society has had standards for the humane treatment of livestock for a long time, and I wondered how Ohio's compared with that. Was it stricter or less strict or whatever? Thank you.
David Glauer?
I don't recall, and I'd refer to Brian, too. I don't recall that the Humane Society, per se, has a set of standards. There is the American Humane Society that's based out of Colorado, and they have a set of standards and are doing some auditing. And so when we got involved in writing the rules, there was some input about from the Humane Society that they didn't want to see cows drug, you know, that kind of thing, you know, down animals going to market. And so we've dealt with those kinds of issues. But as far as them coming in here and giving us a set of standards, that's not what they're about. But the American Humane Society is a different based group of people who do set some standards, and they are fairly strict.
And I think you said earlier Ohio's kind of the poster child for the rest of the country. It might have been you, Brian Black, that said that. So are other states doing this, or are they doing it more piecemeal, or how's it working?
Well, I think they've investigated how we've done it, and I've had several calls from producers around the country who have done separate things. I think there's a bill in Oklahoma this fall, 777, I believe it is, and it's kind of a right-to-farm bill. I don't think it gets in quite as in-depth on what we were dealing with, but it's fairly early yet from when we've first put this together, but I think I do know that other states are doing it. And to answer the lady's question, we looked at several resources when we were building the rules or looking and investigating the rules. The National Pork Board, which is the checkoff side of the pork industry, has a what's called pork quality assurance, and it lays out animal handling, all kinds of welfare issues, everything that we will be looking at. We also looked at American Humane and some of the others, and we did run some of this by HSUS because, you know, at the end of the day, it kind of had to pass their muster as well. So felt real comfortable at the end of the day that there were things that both sides got. I know you talked early on about having a opportunity to use individual stalls in certain cases, and that was one area that I talked directly with their CEO about that they just hadn't looked at that aspect of, you know, it may sound good on paper, but in reality, there might be certain circumstances that we need to use these other options.
Even with these standards, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you, even with these standards, is Ohio a good place to farm? Can you make a decent living here?
We're 500 miles from about two-thirds of the population here in Columbus, Ohio. So from a logistics standpoint, from transportation and all that, with the tremendous growth that we have in crop production, we have the access to feed. That's a long answer to say yes, it is absolutely good to and nice to raise livestock in the state of Ohio.
And as Brian mentioned, they also look to Ohio for genetics. You know, we send dairy cattle, we send swine, and some other species, you know, overseas for rebuilding of their population. So it is a great place to farm.
Brian Black, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Brian Black, fourth generation Ohio farmer, past president of the National and the Ohio Pork Producer Councils, and member of the Ohio Livestock Care Standards Boards. And Dr. David Glauer, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ann.
Dr. David Glauer is a former state veterinarian for the Ohio Department of Agriculture, and he helped write the Ohio Livestock Care Standards back a few years ago. And we've been talking about how they're working as they roll out. Thanks for listening to that. Links to the All-Side staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shia Lanat. The Allside's interns, Summer Cartwright, Vaughn Hunt, Sydney Schaefer, and John Schlichting, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WSU News, and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson. Once again, we are broadcasting from the Ohio State Fair today. Our booth, the WSU booth, is at the center of the park, at the Central Park, and it's PBS Kids Day at the fair, so get the kids out here. They'll be here till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Thank you so much for listening. This is Allsides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.